You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. There have been a wide variety of radio stations on the airwaves over the years. Commercial, music and talk, public radio, community stations, and going back to the beginning, radio broadcasting run by colleges, universities, and their students. From early experimental stations, including 9XM here in Wisconsin, campus radio stations evolved and at many points became really influential, even past the boundaries of their campuses. In addition to providing unique music, news, and talk programming on the airwaves, college radio stations have often found themselves on front lines of public debates around education, media, culture, and politics. In her new book, our next guest digs deep into the stories behind college radio. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you listen to college radio as a teenager or while you were in college yourself? Do you still listen to college radio today? What made or makes that special? And were you involved in creating radio on a campus station at some point? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Catherine Rye Jewell is a professor of history at Fitchburg State University in Massachusetts. Her new book is called Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
You've got your own left of the dial college radio story. How did you get involved in college radio?
I do. So I started college radio fresh out of the gate as a first-year student at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. I started in 1997. I actually had no idea that student-run radio was even possible when I got there. I'm from Vermont, and the only college radio station I could pick up was the Dartmouth station, and it was a commercial station, and students really weren't in charge. But I went by the student activities table, saw that there was this radio station, and somehow, some way, they let me on to this 19,000 watt radio station that reached Metro Nashville.
And what inspired you to write this book now, digging deep into the story behind not just that college radio station, but about the concept of college radio even?
Yeah, so I'm a political historian, so I'm interested in regulations and the politics of culture in the 20th century. But in 2011, my alma mater's station was one of a spate of sales where the university decided that radio was no longer this thing that they thought that was valuable for their students to be involved in, at least in a so-called terrestrial radio signal. They still have an online radio station that students can participate in, but they sold their FM signal. And so the historian in me started thinking, well, what is it that we're losing and where did it come from? How did this thing of student-run college radio with this particular role in the music industry that I came to appreciate it for, where did that even come from? How did students get on the air to begin with? And I started looking around and no one had written that history from a national perspective in conversation with the idea of public radio and the regulations behind educational radio that give us a lot of these non-commercial signals on the left side of the dial.
Tell us a little bit about this FM range and this rise of, I think, what we now think of as college radio.
Yeah, so college radio goes back to the beginning of radio itself, that a lot of experimental stations in electrical engineering departments and student clubs were right there at the very beginning of radio, well before the 1920, you know, kind of first commercial broadcast of radio. And it goes through a bunch of different permutations over time, sort of in conversation with how Congress was looking to regulate the airwaves. We get that educational non-commercial set aside in the 1940s, but FM doesn't really take off until the 1960s when you could get a receiver where you would get both. And it's at that moment that universities realize that there is value to their educational missions in getting students on the airwaves, to give them professional experience of broadcasting, but also to create these cultural links between universities and the communities to provide a access point for people around the university to hear what's going on at the university through events or concerts or lectures, but also to have access to the kinds of cultural interests that students had going on. And students really pushed for there to be representation of the kind of music that they were really excited about on these airwaves. So if all these different people coming to college radio with a certain mindset of, you know, here's how it can help us with this particular goal. So there's a lot of voices that shape college radio from the outset, and in particular, since the 1960s.
And all those different voices, there's a tension between them all in almost all the examples you give versus between, hey, we should sound like a professional commercial level station versus let's have fun and be amateurs and learn, or we're serving students, or we're serving the wider community, or we want music that's not on other stations, or we need to do underrepresented sporting events. You can't do all of those. And it seems like that creative tension is always bubbling there.
Yeah. And some of it just relates to the physics of radio. And there's only 168 hours in a week. And, you know, that this is before digital radio. So there weren't multiple signals that people could, you know, divide up and have different types of service on. So that alone limits what stations could do. And your listeners will probably be familiar with the block format, which distinguished these stations from commercial stations, which tended to use a more of a day parting schedule of, you know, you'd have morning drive time and, you know, sort of easy listening maybe during the day for work. College stations tended to divide up the schedule around all of those different claimants. But the thing is, particularly, and this is where the regulatory political piece comes into it, as deregulation starts to affect media, starting in really in the 1980s, those non-commercial stations become some of the few places that communities could go to for service. And there's all of these market pressures on universities to kind of prove their worth. And radio was a place where they could do that, both educationally and in broadcasting the benefits of the university to wider communities. And so the stakes become a lot higher. And so these stations become a real crossroads over culture and whose voice gets to be heard, you know, and backed up by the institutional investment of these institutions that are sort of interested in bigger things than what, you know, is going to be the next big hit and the next sort of driver of the commercial music industry.
Talking to Catherine Rye Jewell about her new book, Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Alicia joins us now, called from here in Wisconsin. Alicia, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to participate in this broadcast.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm original from California. In 1992, I started working at Capital Public Radio, which was a college radio station that became National Public Radio sister station. And it was a really fun incredible time that I had there, because at the time, I don't know if you remember.
Oop, we're losing your signal there, Alicia. I'm so sorry, but thanks for sharing that experience. And Kate, speaking of tensions, there was another tension between NPR and some college stations, and within college stations, should we air NPR content? Should we try to sound more like NPR? Can you talk about that a little?
Absolutely. So a lot of NPR signals stations, as we think of them now, get their start on college signals. And that was part of the deal in creating the Public Broadcasting Act under, you know, the Lyndon Johnson administration that gave us public television as well. In the 1970s, though, there's a bit of a split that takes place between stations that go the public broadcasting route, which tended to air more syndicated content, news and information, and syndicated cultural programming versus the student-run kind of educational stations. But the thing is that there's no clear, bright line between the two of them. And at a lot of stations, they would air maybe NPR news and information in the morning or in the evening, and then they would switch back to student-run radio during the day or community-run shows. And a lot of tension sprung up over, do we expand those hours? Do we bring in more professional staff and have the students be interns, while at the same time understanding that that gave students a lot of really fantastic professional experience? So what's the better educational experience, giving them new experience on a news and information program behind the scenes, doing the work of a producer, or being on air themselves and picking the music and crafting their own show? And I would argue that both of those things have educational value, but it's really hard to do both of those things on the same station. And so over time, you see a lot of really big, very tense battles over whether or not stations are going to kind of go NPR.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Catherine Rye-Jewell, Associate Professor of History at Fitchburg State University. Her new book is Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. You can join in with your own experiences, your stories, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from a bunch of you there. Some shout-outs to stations. Glenn gives a shout-out to WGBW in Green Bay. Dave has WMUA in Amherst, Massachusetts. James says he was a DJ at WWSP in Stevens Point in the mid-2000s. And James says, I've been playing in their famous annual trivia contest since 1991. Keep sharing your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. That's a 1985 song by The Replacements called Left of the Dial. That term Left of the Dial refers to non-commercial radio that airs on a reserved band, the FM spectrum. That includes college radio, our topic now with historian Catherine Rye-Jewell. Her new book is called Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in Beloit. Nick, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
I have an odd question. So I know in radio for a long time, back in the old days of radio, there was this big push to not play what the young people wanted because it was too subversive. But then, according to this, we have young people, like, playing their music, whatever they want, on a college radio station. Was that seen as kind of contradictory, or did culture change, or did something happen where maybe we couldn't play young people's music again at some point? That's what I was curious about.
Nick, thanks for the call. Kate, you spend a lot of time talking about the music that ends up on college radio stations and a whole genre, college rock, coming out of this.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to think about this idea of the role that college radio plays in youth culture and bringing youth culture up to the level where it can influence what we might think of as mainstream culture. And the idea of the subversive music is something that is very much at the heart of the book. And, you know, what the idea of maybe obscene music or indecent music, and that is a kind of political or legal concept, is something that's really malleable throughout these years. And you tend to see the courts resorting to, right, what local preferences are when it comes to determining what gets allowed on the airwaves or not. And the bar for obscenity tends to be really, really high. And in all of the research I did, there's only one station that lost its license for obscenity. But really, it was because the administration kind of forgot it had a radio station and just wasn't managing it. And that was WXPN at the University of Pennsylvania in the 1970s. But there was an incident where the PMRC, your listeners might remember Tipper Gore and the hearings in 1985, with Dee Snider from Twisted Sister and John Denver and Frank Zappa kind of squaring off over the content of music. But the thing is that those debates kind of really weren't about radio, because they were already governed by the FCC and there were already guardrails on what could be played or not. Really, those debates were about labeling music so that consumers could make a, you know, kind of informed choice. But the PMRC does get involved in one radio station at the University of California at Santa Barbara. So a student there complained about what was going on. It went all the way to the PMRC and they got the FCC involved. And they did get a little slap on the wrist, a reprimand, not a fine. But what it tells us is that we see this idea of the culture wars and the content of music becoming more nationalized in the 1980s. So what's going on in an individual station is no longer being seen through the lens of local media and local cultures, but rather through this kind of national idea of the culture wars. And these stations and college students get kind of swept up into that in this one really remarkable case. But for the majority of stations, they're really fearful about getting caught because these are small stations. They have small budgets. If they get fined, it's probably more than their annual budget. And so there's this kind of chilling effect that happens across stations where they're really careful about what they're going to play. They might reserve the most challenging content for maybe after 10 p.m., the so-called safe harbor hours.
Thanks for that call. Pat joins us now in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Greetings. I don't know how long I'm going to have you, so I'll make this real quick. I was in high school. Our high school had a radio station in Green Bay back in the 70s. I actually held a third-class radio telephone operator's license. But I remember, having to watch what music we played. You know, you couldn't play anything controversial. Pretty much anything that we got for free. You know, we all hustled for music. And I still remember to this day, I don't know how many people really know about it, but the original album cover from Queen, Day at the Races, was X-rated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Pat, thanks a lot for sharing that. So that was a high school station even, but Kate, you talk to a lot of people who had done college radio. I hear a lot of joy from Pat and thinking about the memory. Did you encounter that a lot?
Absolutely. This tends to be one of people's most favorite memories, most cherished memories. And there's something sort of magical about speaking into a microphone in this little room. And, you know, for those people who maybe participated in college radio, these weren't always like the fanciest studios. They usually had some kind of smelly couch and covered in stickers. You know, so you're in this little room sequester, but you're talking out to the mic and you're reaching people in really intimate ways. And, you know, you're in their car with them, you're in their living room with them. And for somebody to be able to put together a slate of music that really speaks to a listener is a really fabulous kind of connection. I think that's really at the heart of the sentiment that we have towards these experiences. And in high school and college, I talked to a lot of people who had done radio in high school, and it's just as valued and oftentimes was just as influential as some of the college stations. Artists wanted to get their music on the high school stations as much as they did on the college stations.
Talking to Catherine Rye Jewell about her new book, Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. We asked around here at WPR about college radio experiences. Not surprising. Got a lot. Here's an audio one from our own Trina LaSousa.
I was very involved at the college student radio station, WSUM 91.7 FM Madison. And I truly loved my experience in college radio. I had the opportunity to be the lead talk show host and lead producer of EarthSpeak Radio, which was an environmental talk show. And I also got to host my own positive vibes reggae music show. And I really think it inspired me for my current career in radio today.
And that speaks, Kate, to another role you look at. College radio is a training ground for people who went on to work in media, TV, musicians, people in the music industry. It was also a job training for a lot of people.
Absolutely. I mean, stars from Tom Morello in Rage Against the Machine. He still has a radio show on Sirius XM. Music writers coming out of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. There would oftentimes be these links and, you know, networks that people were able to follow into radio, into broadcasting from their college radio station. But at the same time, even those of us who didn't necessarily envision a career in broadcasting got so many benefits from it. You know, I'm a college professor, and I think one of the reasons that I'm so capable of standing up in front of a room of the toughest audience in the world of college students and being able to teach is my experience on college radio, that it kind of broke through a lot of the fears that I had about either just public speaking, but also being able to find my voice. And I always quote Chuck D from Public Enemy, who is a college radio DJ at WBAU and on Long Island and at Adelphi University. And he always says that college radio is what helped him find his voice as an artist and to figure out what it was he really wanted to say.
Kate, under a minute for a big question. Your hopes for the future of college radio?
College radio is alive and well. Despite stations like mine having been sold, it is still very possible to get on the airwaves, both for college students and community members. It doesn't have the same role in the music industry that it used to. But the thing is that college students and community members are really creative, and they are going to figure out something exciting to do with these stations that goes way beyond just music discovery.
Kate, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Catherine Rye Jewell, professor of history at Fitchburg State University in Massachusetts. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio, and hearing some of your stories about listening to or DJing at college radio stations. You can keep sharing your memories or what you're doing right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, two members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation join the show for a look at U.S. policy in Gaza. We'll hear from one from each party. And this week's edition of Food Friday is a great one for this state and for this time of year. We'll get advice on making amazing cheese boards and relish trays and other great food displays for entertaining during the holidays or any time. You can get started right now. Do you have a magical secret to share about how to make the perfect cheese board for company? Let us know right now. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Many people say money can't buy happiness, but according to polls, a lot of people also think that having more money would make them more happy. A recent survey from the financial company Empower found that most people think more money would solve most of their problems. Men reported needing more money to be happy than did women. Millennials think they're going to need more money to be happy than other generations. Other research from Princeton, the University of Pennsylvania, and elsewhere found that happiness levels seem to rise as income increases, but that gain in happiness starts to plateau at around $100,000 a year. Around the holiday season, issues of money and happiness come up a lot. Do more expensive gifts or gatherings make us more happy? We're exploring the relationship between money and happiness, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think money can buy happiness, or does having the right amount of money give you the potential to be happy? Does not worrying about money make you happier? And how do you approach the holidays when it comes to how much to spend, say, on gifts for each other, or do you find non-monetary ways to give gifts to each other? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Christine Whelan is a clinical professor of consumer science in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's the author of several books and Finding Your Purpose, a best-selling Audible original lecture series. She's the director of the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative. Christine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
Now, when you look at all the data out there, and you've done a lot of work on this yourself about, you know, the link between money and happiness, how do you start to sort it all out? Are there levels of monetary well-being that make us more happy?
So the idea is that you can't buy happiness, but I try to take that approach that, in fact, you kind of can if you know how to spend your money right. So it's really less about amassing more money and more about spending in keeping with your values, spending in a way that feels purposeful and meaningful to you, spending on experiences more than things. But at the end of the day, yeah, if you're not able to pay your bills, if you don't have a cushion, then that can make you kind of unhappy.
Right. It may seem obvious. I kind of flip it around and think of it in the negative way. Not having enough money, having to worry about meeting the basic needs of day-to-day life, that can make you unhappy.
Financial concerns are a real thing for a lot of Americans. In fact, people say they are kept up at night about their financial concerns. These are ones that if you can alleviate, yeah, then you are happier. But this idea that if I won the lottery, if I won millions, all my problems would be solved, research actually shows that's not true either. You get a momentary kind of burst of happiness. But then there's this thing called hedonic adaptation. We tend to get used to the good things in life. They become normal, and then we need more to stay happy.
Yeah, and as we maybe level up financially, it just seems like a new set of worries. More money, more problems is the phrase. But, can I afford my rent this month? Okay, well, I'm more secure, but I've got this mortgage I've got to pay now or whatever. As we hit new levels of income, we may take on new burdens that make us just as worried.
Exactly. I think for people who are financially sort of stable, we can say, oh, come on, you don't need money to be happy. But that actually is a fairly privileged position, because if you need to meet your basic needs and you benchmark happiness around that, actually, more money in our society is a lot of the security that we need to know that we can retire when we want to retire, that we can send our kids to school in new clothes for the year. So with those sort of feeling like a quote-unquote normal American, those things really do cost money, and money can buy that.
And you mentioned earlier, and I want to dig into this, the way we use our resources, the way we use our money in particular. If we use it right, we can find ways to enhance our happiness. How do we start to audit what we're spending money on to figure out, hey, is this the best way to enhance my happiness?
So the classic example is we want to buy experiences more than we want to buy things. You can get bored of a thing. We do get bored of things. But if you're like me, every time you have an experience, the story gets better and better in the retelling. So, experiences tend to bring you more happiness than things. That's one big one. The other one, though, is a little bit counterintuitive. So certainly having smaller experiences more frequently that bring you happiness can bring a burst of joy to the day. So in this study, the young people in particular said buying a $7 coffee every day was something that would make them happy. But paradoxically, actually not buying that $7 coffee 4 out of the 5 days work days of the week would make that fifth coffee that much more special.
I have so totally experienced this in my life. Not with the coffee, the fancy coffee so much, but I have a sweet tooth. And I've fallen into habits here at work, and I'm out of it now, of like every day I get a cookie or a treat or something. When I do that every day, it's okay. It's a habit. When I do it once a month, it's a treat, and I enjoy it. It's actually an experience then. That fits right in.
So we adapt, right? Humans adapt to good, to bad. And if our coffee or our treat just becomes the thing we do, we don't get as much pleasure out of it. Ancient cultures have known this forever. Religions have known this forever, right? This is the idea of renunciation, so that when you get the treat, you like it that much more. We can put this to practice in our everyday lives.
Talking to Christine Whelan from UW-Madison's School of Human Ecology, talking about money and happiness, how they do and don't always overlap. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Was there a point in your life where you thought, hey, I have enough money now and I feel better, more secure in my life? When you're spending money on yourself or on others, what kind of things make you the most happy? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's put this into practice, Christine, with holiday gift buying. Some people are already done. Well done, if you are. Some people are still out there looking for things. How do we start to take these concepts of what we want to do to make ourselves happy and make other people happy instead?
Well, first you need to know what the money language or the gift language that someone speaks. Are they going to like a handmade gift? Are they going to appreciate more the gift of your time rather than something that's monetarily expensive? And then from there, I really like focusing on gifts that I can do with the other person. So it is a gift of my time. And even just setting a date for a coffee with somebody can be a gift, because you know that you're going to be able to spend time with them. So not all gifts have to be expensive. If you have children, though, a lot of those gifts need to be wrapped and under a tree, perhaps. If that's the case, then budgeting is really important, because what you don't want to do is go into debt over your holiday buying, because this idea of buying now and paying later, that actually undermines your financial happiness. It's better to pay now and enjoy later when possible.
We had a caller on an unrelated topic earlier this week, actually. Marcus in Milwaukee called in, I remember, and he said one of his favorite childhood gift memories was not the stuff under the tree, but I think it was a family member who every year took him and the other kids on a nature walk and explained, you know, some of the science of nature and the ecology and things like that. That stuck with him well into his adult life. How do we start to craft those experiences for kids or grownups?
So really, it's giving of yourself. It is, and that really, you know, when we think about things that are valuable in our lives, our time, our energy, our emotional resources are incredibly valuable as well, not just money. So giving of yourself and creating those traditions. So those are really wonderful. You could do it by cooking together. You can do it by going on a nature walk together. In fact, you can really even do it by just organizing an event that doesn't have to cost money.
Now, I want to look at attitudes toward money and happiness. I mentioned, at least in this one survey, millennials thinking they would need more money to be happy. As you look across generations, and I know generational lines aren't as hard and fast as we in the media make them out to me to be, but do you see differences from generation to generation in attitudes toward money and happiness?
The differences are really in terms of age, and it turns out that younger people believe that they need more money to be happy than older folks. And this has held true throughout the generations that we have survey data on anyway. So think about the millennials. Well, they do need more money because they're in the stage where they're raising children. Mm-hmm. They're trying to think about paying for college for those children, and the costs of everything are really high. When you think about folks who are maybe empty nesters who are heading toward retirement, perhaps they feel like they maybe need less because they have fewer expenses. So, yeah, young people, as we look toward our lives, then we say, gosh, we need a lot. But as we get older, then we can say, well, maybe some of those relationships do actually matter more than the shiny objects.
We hear a lot about how the greatest generation, their attitudes toward money were shaped in large part by the Great Depression. I wonder if the millennials who hit the Great Recession in many cases, you know, just as they were entering into the job market, if that may have shaped their perception of the need for financial security.
It certainly could have, and we will see that as we see whether the next generations are ones that in their sort of peak child-raising years also feel like they need more money. But, you know, these are sort of times where inflation is really putting a pinch on a lot of us, and we are feeling that things are costing more because they are costing more. And you know what we really hate as humans is feeling like we're losing something. Mm-hmm. And so with inflation, if you can't afford the things that you used to be able to afford, that puts increased money stress, and you feel like you need more than what you have.
Talking to UW-Madison consumer science professor Christine Whelan about the relationship between money and happiness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do money and happiness work together in your life? Or do the things that make you the most happy tend to cost the least, or maybe even nothing at all? And when you're giving or receiving gifts, what kind of things do you remember over the years? What kind of things make you the happiest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Christine Whelan, clinical professor of consumer science and director of the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative at UW-Madison. She's with us today to talk about the connections and disconnections between money and happiness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about money and happiness? What are the things, if you spend money on them, is it the experiences that you remember that bring you happiness, maybe even long after those experiences are done? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring out a caller. Oh, hey, it's the caller I mentioned earlier, Marcus in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Rob?
Good. What did you want to tell us about? You can expand a little bit on what I talked about earlier.
Certainly. So my Uncle Don, he was an incredible individual. He was the one that used to take us for the nature walk. Mm. But he was also part of the greatest generation. And he used to say, work to live, don't live to work. separate your wants from your needs. Always cover your needs and occasionally cover your wants. Save the rest and do this for a very long time.
Marcus, thank you so much for sharing that. Now, let's take that to something you think a lot about, a purpose. And when Marcus is talking about his uncle saying, work to live, don't live to work, that's getting into our purpose in life, why we do what we do.
So that was one of the interesting things in this study that you cited, was that, in fact, most people said that they would quit their jobs if they did not have to work. And so this idea of work to live is something that I think a lot of Americans are thinking about right now. I like to think about it in terms of what are your core values that you want to bring to everything you do, both paid and unpaid. And so one of the things I do with my students in the Consuming Happiness class that I teach is we do a sort of financial purpose statement where we think about our core values. Then we think about what we're good at and who we want to positively impact. And then with that, we kind of also acknowledge some of the fears and anxieties that might come along the way and then make some financial commitments to spend in keeping with our values. So if you think about the last three things you bought, were they in keeping with your values? And that's often a challenging question for a lot of people.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marcus, at 800-642-1234. I think one exercise you've tried with your students as the follow-up is you have them, write their core values on a sticky note and then stick them to their credit card?
Indeed. So if you put your core values on your credit card, stick them on there, then every time you think about making a purchase, you have to challenge yourself. Is this in keeping with my values? Now, the thing is, we can get pretty creative with this, and I can justify just about anything.
I value this donut.
I do. It's important to have energy, isn't it?
Now, I think about this, I don't know, what are my core values? I don't know. How do you start that exercise and figure out, what do I value?
So values are the thing that underpin all the choices we make, and yet we don't often talk about them, mm-hmm. right? So values are not things like, I want to be happy, right? Happiness is not a value. Happiness is a byproduct of living your values. Perhaps you value honesty. Perhaps you value industriousness. Perhaps you value spending time with your family. The other thing that's challenging about your values is that they will collide. So let's say one of my core values is spending time with my family. But one of the other things that I like to do is translate academic research and teach. Those things may have to occur at the same time. So how do you choose which value to prioritize? When you're talking about money, you can't fund all of your financial wants and needs and priorities all the time, mm-hmm. right? A lot of us can't anyway. And especially if you're in a relationship with someone. What if I value something and you value something else? Whose values get funded? This is why finances often create all sorts of tension in relationships.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in River West. Pat, hi.
Oh, hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm actually on my way to a store to pick up some working materials. But, yeah, I grew up in that – I'm 61 in that era of that gentleman two commenters ago said work to live, not live to work. But I think I miss a little of the last – the person maybe that's holding this or wrote a book about this, the woman that was just speaking, it gets gray gets confusing, because if you can find something you love to do that makes money or that allows you to get by or be a luxurious life, that would be the pinnacle. But something that gets by but you love doing it, help like an organization that helps environment or people, or it's creative, an artist, musicians, the starving artist. That's really the working to live, if you want to categorize it that. And I think it's such an antiquated. I think that comment could be. Gotcha. It's so compartmentalizing, and everyone thinks the same. And the woman that was just speaking said, you might I sift through my construction materials to kick out this. The metal nails and metal edge trimming to recycle it.
Pat, I got you. We don't have a lot of time left, but thanks a lot for calling in. It's the dream, I guess, in some ways, to have a job that really aligns with our values. there's a lot of jobs out there that need doing. Can everybody find that job that aligns with their values, do you think, Christine?
I do believe that you can find purpose and meaning in every job. And also, your paid job does not have to be your purpose and calling in life. So the idea of putting food on the table, of paying your bills, supporting your family, that's really purposeful work in and of itself. So certainly we want to be passionate about our job, but we can also be passionate about other things. And when it comes to this idea of having those conversations about money, the most important thing is to talk about it. What do you care about? What do I care about? And really talking about passion, purpose, and values along with money goes a long way.
Thanks a lot for that call. We also heard from James and Stevens Point, who says money has a lot to do with happiness, but happiness is bigger than money. Health is also a really big part of it. Thanks, James, for passing that along. Yeah, being in times of bad health can make happiness difficult, but I know a lot of people who are living through tough times can also find at least moments of happiness. How do we bring health into the equation?
So more money can buy better health care. Mm-hmm. It can buy better access to health services. So money does come into play there. At the same time, all the money in the world isn't going to be useful for you if you're on your deathbed, right? So this is where it depends on where you are in life. When I talk to my college students about how much money they want to make, they're at the beginning of their careers. And I encourage them to work hard. So it's not about necessarily how much money do you have right now. It's about how much work are you willing to do to put in toward your larger goals. Then as life goes on, then maybe your priorities shift a little bit. You want to focus more on your family. I think of it as the first part of your life is saying yes to opportunity. The second part of your life is saying no so that you can say yes to all the things that you've agreed to already. And then it's the so what element of what is all of this for. And at different parts of your life, money is going to play a different role.
All right. Now, here's a scenario. Somebody takes your advice and starts thinking about their core values and then starts looking at what they're doing and realizes, the life I've built for myself does not align with what I started off thinking I believe. How do we start to adjust and align in that way?
So you have two choices. Either you can change your behavior or you can change your stated values. And oftentimes we actually behave in the way that we really do value. And it's just that we say we want to value other things, perhaps because they're shoulds that are put on us from other people, not our core values. So before you say, I've got to change everything I do, think about whether you are happy with the life that you are living. And perhaps you are living that way because you value something else other than the story that you're telling publicly.
Christine, we'll leave it there. Always good to talk to you.
Oh, this is fun. Hope to talk to you again.
That's Christine Whelan, clinical professor of consumer science in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's the author of several books on happiness and finding purpose in life. She's the director of the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative. She joined us today for a discussion about the relationship between happiness and money. Well, you can keep sharing your stories on those topics. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. And if there is a gift that you've given or received that was a big hit, that really made people happy, maybe the giver and the receiver, love to hear about that. Share that in the email, ideas@wpr.org. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.